Ladies, finding a partner who smells good, has a full set of teeth, and a paid job is an achievement. But what if you land all that and then you find their political beliefs are a world apart from your own? We are putting together an episode about relationships that cross political lines, and we want to hear from you. Maybe you found a way to bridge that political divide, or maybe it was your undoing. Send us a voice note or an email to ladies@abc.net.au.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I was mopping the floor and I got a call. It went to voicemail because I didn't recognize the number.
The call takes place in Martha's Vineyard, playground for the US Eastern elite. Holiday home of the Kennedys and the Obamas, old money and seclusion. If you have to isolate in a pandemic, this is not a bad place to do it. And in March 2020, Belle Burden is sheltering with her husband and two daughters and feeling pretty stoic about it.
And then I played the message, and it was a man's voice, and he said, "I'm sorry to tell you this, but your husband is having an affair with my wife." And I thought, this just can't be true. This can't be correct. Went to find my husband, and he was coming to find me, and we sat down in our guest room, and I just waited for him to explain it. He said it didn't mean anything. It was only a couple of weeks, that he loved me, he loved our family, and that we were his priority.
Belle wanted to know about this other woman.
It felt important to know her name, which he told me. And then I asked if she had children, which he told me she had two young kids. I asked how they met. And then my younger daughter called asking for a snack for some turnovers.
Kids always find a way to interrupt in the middle of a crisis.
I immediately knew that I had to hide this bomb that had gone off. I stayed up most of the night just stunned by this having happened and trying to put it together with what I knew of my husband, which was someone who was very kind, very steady, seemingly very devoted to me and to our kids.
At 6 a.m. the next morning, Belle's husband walked into their bedroom.
And at that point, I thought, okay, we're going to have to do therapy on Zoom. We're going to have to, like, work through this. It'll be awful, but I will do it.
If he meant what he said about the affair meaning nothing, then Belle was prepared at this point to try and save the marriage of 20 years.
But he walked into the room with his bag packed and he said, "I've decided I'm not happy and I want a divorce."
So between the night before when he said it meant nothing, it was just a one-off thing, it was just a short-term thing, and the morning he'd had a complete change of heart.
All of a sudden there was a different person standing there. His eyes became something completely different, very icy, very cold. And he got in his Jeep and he got on a ferry and he left the island.
From that moment, life as Belle had known it started to unravel. Stable marriage, gone. Financial security, gone. Reliable co-parent, gone. Belle's written a memoir, Strangers, about the disintegration of her marriage and what happens when the person you've shared your life with becomes someone you don't recognise. I'm Yumi Steins. Ladies, we need to talk about betrayal with Belle Burden. Belle just hadn't seen any of the warning signs.
We were a pretty peaceful couple, you know, looked pretty perfect on the outside, and I believed, not perfect, but that we were in a healthy marriage on the inside.
After Belle's husband returned to their apartment in New York, she tried desperately to get answers from him.
I could not stop crying. I couldn't eat. I just kept calling him, trying to get some kind of understanding of what had happened and why he felt this way, and he would give me nothing. And meanwhile, he was just completely calm. You know, he eventually stopped answering the phone calls. But, you know, almost overnight, I went from being, you know, a pretty stable mother, lawyer, wife to this hysterical person because I was just very upset. So that time was really wrenching.
But amid the emotional furor, Belle couldn't just collapse into a heap. She had children to care for.
At that point, I knew I just had to keep putting one foot in front of the other and keep washing the toilets and going to the grocery store. And I pretended for a long time with the girls that nothing was happening. So I was trying to put on this facade at the same time. So it was really just day by day.
It sounds horrendous. So you did keep it a secret from your kids for quite a long time and went through the motions, even though they must have found the patterns of your behaviour very disrupted. But I guess it was a very disrupted time. Then hubby arrives to tell them in person on a light plane, sponsored by his boss. So he swoops down on an aeroplane. How did that go?
Well, it was a horrible moment. And I'm a child of divorce. So this was very painful for me, this moment where we were going to tell them.
Belle's son was staying with friends during the lockdowns. So it was her daughters, who were 12 and 15 at the time, who were there to hear the news.
So he came, we sat in the living room. I had my arms around each of them. And he told them that he hadn't been happy and that he wanted a divorce. And my younger daughter initially thought he was joking. She looked at me and thought maybe it was a joke and then saw the expression on my face and she screamed and ran downstairs. My older daughter just sat there with her arms crossed, just looking at her father. And then he looked at me and he said, "I'm starving. Will you make me a sandwich?"
Yep. He actually said, "I'm starving. Will you make me a sandwich?" The audacity. Fair enough if your first instinct might be to think that Belle told him where he could stick his sandwich or perhaps even made him a shit sandwich, but she was better than that and chose the high road.
So I went in the kitchen and I tried to make the best sandwich I could ever make. I just knew I did not want to make a bad sandwich. And I think part of me wanted him to maybe think like, how could I leave a woman who makes such good sandwiches? So that's what I did. And in the meantime, he went down to the basement and started looking for our prenup.
It is so much. Do you reflect on that sandwich at all, Belle? Like, do you kind of go, maybe I wouldn't have made such a nice sandwich if I had my time over again?
It kind of shows how he was just in a very different place than I was. He was living a very different narrative where everything was fine, where you're allowed to leave like this and everything's fine. And if you say everything's fine enough times, maybe it actually is fine. But for those of us who are kind of in the emotional wreckage, it felt very out of place.
What did he say about the sort of relationship he wanted to have with the kids?
So the first day that he left, he said, "You can have the house and the apartment and you can have custody. I don't want custody of the kids." And that has been the most difficult part of this. I very much wanted joint custody. I wanted the kids to go back and forth, especially our 12-year-old. So I think he really felt, in addition to the switch turning, he said, "They're fully formed human beings. I was a great dad, and now I'm done."
It's like his whole entire life. He just wanted to hit reboot on it.
Except for his job. He stayed in his job. So it would have almost made more sense if he quit his job, he went to another continent, he created a whole different life.
Yeah, sure.
He's still, you know, in this neighborhood and still working at his job. So some of that's hard to put together.
It sounds like he had to emotionally amputate parts of himself.
Yes, I think so. Compartmentalize and just shed that, or amputate, as you said, that part of himself.
And you must be dying of curiosity to know what he's replaced all that with, but you didn't have much of a window into his new life.
I really didn't. And for a while, I really fixated on whether he was still with the woman he'd had the affair with. You know, I really didn't get, even though we have friends in common, I did not get any information about a new woman or a marriage or anything like that. I don't know what his day-to-day life is like at all.
Right. He could have a dog. You wouldn't even know.
I wouldn't even know.
It's so weird. Eventually, you had to leave Martha's Vineyard and go back to New York and try and start life there again. And I'm talking to you. You're in New York. What was it like going back to the city and it was still in the middle of COVID?
It was challenging, but it was challenging for everybody. I had an added layer of just trying to figure out who I was going to be and how I was going to kind of get through the actual divorce part of it. You know, it was an isolated time for all of us. So it was hard to see friends. It was hard to connect with people. But in a way, it also felt like a protected time because I didn't have to go to school pickup. I didn't have to expose myself in a lot of ways. So it was sort of a nice cocoon.
Tell me about seeing your husband for the first time in New York.
The first time and for at least a year afterwards, I would see him, you know, approaching on the street or when I first saw him on standing on the sidewalk, my immediate feeling is there's my husband. There's, you know, there's the man I love because I never got to unwind from the relationship. He did because he was having an affair and everything, but I went from everything to nothing. So my body would sort of have a physical reaction when I would see him like, oh, you know, there he is. And I had to really kind of train myself out of that.
Gosh.
And that was really hard. But he seemed like his whole affect seemed very different. So he was very recognizable and then in some ways not recognizable.
Tell me more about that. Why did he look so different?
Well, first of all, he looked elated. Like he looked incredibly happy. Like he just looked, and I was like, you know, a shell of myself. He'd been working out, so he had looked a little more fit, but he didn't look physically that different, but his affect, the elation was very unfamiliar to me.
So after the husband got back to New York, where I don't want to call him your husband, he's just the husband, the ex-husband. After he got back to New York where you lived, what did he say to you about the reasons why he didn't want to be in the marriage? Like he said infidelity, but did he give you any clue about what was going on in his heart and soul?
The most specific thing he told me was that he felt that a switch had gone off and that there was no going back. He just said, this is not your fault. Something broke in me. And so there is a real void still of information about why.
And I bet you felt like you deserved more than him just saying it wasn't you.
Yes, I think he thought that would be enough for me, and it really wasn't. After 20 years and 3 kids and a life, it's really not enough.
So when you had resettled into New York, can you explain how your ex wanted to be involved as a parent to the kids?
He felt that, I think he felt that his job was done. The first year, there was just nothing. There was absolutely nothing. You know, I had to get my son through high school and he was not the most conscientious student and then get him applying to college. And, you know, there's just a lot with kids and he was just not going to get involved in that level of detail. When he would see them, he was sweet with them. But it was like he just really changed. And with the girls, especially, I had to try and explain that in a way without real answers, which hopefully could make them see that it really wasn't about them, that it was not a rejection of them. And that was challenging.
You write in the book about the home videos that your former husband used to take and this sort of carefulness that he had in capturing your lives that must have felt very incongruous with the man who kind of ditched the lot of you.
They really do. And I watched them all again after he left. And they really are very loving. And he took so much time with them.
Wow.
And he really took care to have these different interests with them, whether it was going for soup dumplings in Chinatown or going to musicals or hockey games. I think we had a real division of labor, which is he worked a lot and I was more kid focused. But when he was there, he was very present and he really wanted to be that kind of father. And he is very much a different kind of father now.
Not only was she faced with this suddenly unfamiliar man who was still packaged as someone she'd known for over 20 years, Belle was also hit with his proposal for their financial settlement.
Before we got married, we signed a prenup, which my family insisted on because I had some trusts from my father and my grandfather. And my ex-husband, before we got married, asked to have the provision in the document changed where we would share money made during the marriage equally, so that we would only share money made during the marriage if we affirmatively put it in joint names.
Oh, yeah. You know where this is going.
I had taken my money out of trust to buy our homes and put them in joint names, because I thought that's what you do in a marriage. You share everything and you put things in joint names, even though he had not contributed to the purchases. Meanwhile, he was making a lot of money. We met at a law firm, but he went into the world of hedge funds. And without my knowledge, it was growing, 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 all in his name. So when our prenup was enforced, he was allowed to keep all his money. And then he claimed his half of our house and apartment, which I could not afford to buy him out.
Mm. That's so gross, too, that he was, the very first time you saw him, he was fossicking around for the prenup in the basement. Like, he just,
yes.
Do you think he had his eye on that the whole time?
I think definitely. I mean, this was like just a few weeks after he'd left. He was very focused on it and we couldn't find it anywhere else. And then what's chilling to me is that he, even before we got married, he was thinking about this. Mm. Like, to change the prenup in that way is someone who's protecting themselves to a really large degree. It's not the norm in a prenup to do that.
I think with a lot of us who've been divorced, and I'm one of those people, you long for a reckoning and a bit of a maybe bloodletting or truth-telling, just some sort of spillage of all the words and all the questions, and you get to air everything out and you get some resolution. And I think we crave to be heard and for things to be resolved. You've never had that. Like, you're so far from that. So can you help us to understand how you survived it without going completely batshit crazy? And also, like, how do you find peace there with no resolution?
I definitely had my moments of going batshit crazy, for sure. You want some acknowledgement also of your pain, of, you know, how hard this is for you. So to get none of that was really difficult. I think it's just moving forward, just, and even just, you know, I walked a lot, just one step forward and really trying not to think about him and trying to create my life and get pleasure from, you know, I went back to my maiden name, you know, getting pleasure from taking control of my finances, starting to write again, and sort of getting this exhilaration from my independence and autonomy.
Bell wrote about the separation in a column for the famous New York Times Modern Love section.
In writing about it, I think I start to, without any explanation from him, I think about it in a certain way, which is, he wore the costume and then he played the role. And then I think he was playing it for himself, and then he just couldn't continue playing it anymore. And he did not know how to leave gracefully. That's where I park it in my brain. And I think that helps me.
Yeah. And it sounds like you've managed to finally stop thinking about him so much.
Yes, finally, finally.
Mm.
Which, I mean, the irony is I now have a book and I'll be talking about him a lot.
Is there a certain, I don't know if schadenfreude's the word, is there a certain sort of ticklish delight that you have in knowing that he is the subject of this book and he has no control over it?
I think I still worry about him and I don't want to hurt him, so I still have those instincts. I think the thing that delights me is that he and a lot of other people thought I would just stay quiet about it. It delights me that this is out there and that I've surprised them and that they underestimated me, not in terms of bringing him down, but they underestimated me in terms of being able to write something like this and being absolutely open and honest about what happened.
You just let go of the decorum that they were expecting.
Yes.
Of you. I really have this image of you too now, Belle, of somebody who was in the shadows a bit during your marriage, and then you've become fully actualized after it ended. And it's sort of wonderful. I mean, it's delightful to be witnessing it, but do you ever wonder what would have happened if the marriage hadn't ended?
I do. And, or if, you know, I had decided to forgive him for the affair and that he wanted to stay and what that would have been like. And I honestly, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I honestly would not choose that. I'm really happy that I'm living this life right now. And as I said before, I would never have chosen it. It had to be imposed on me because I longed so much for, you know, marriage and family and an intact family that I never would have chosen it. And I think if we'd stayed together after the affair and he was not willing to really talk about it, that would have been a really awful place to be.
That would have been a prison.
Yes, exactly.
What happened with the divorce settlement in the end, Belle?
In the end, I was able to keep my house and my apartment.
Okay.
We settled 45 minutes before trial.
Oh my God.
And I had to really thread the needle and try and get him to the place where he would let me keep both places that I had bought and where the kids were living. And he pays child support. But other than that, he exited with his fortune. And I had to make peace with that.
There's always a shit sandwich, my friends. That is my experience of divorce. Someone eventually has to eat the shit sandwich. And it sucks. Your book is titled Strangers. Mm-hmm. Is that how you think of him now?
I do. I really don't know him. I see him occasionally on the street, and I know very little about him, about how his mind works, about who he is now, about what his life is like. So yes, I do think of him as a stranger.
And are you in the dating pool?
I'm really not. I don't say no to it. And I've gone on blind dates, but nothing has really clicked for me. I can't quite do the online thing because it just feels so vulnerable, like I'm not there yet. The way I think about it is the universe has not brought it to me at this point, and I have been so focused on the book and my law practice and the kids that, you know, I'm very content if it ends up just being me and I'm the grandmother with grandchildren and all that stuff. But it's funny because it does make people uncomfortable. They really want me to be coupled again, especially immediately afterwards. Like that was going to be the solution to everything.
Yeah.
And I think some people still feel that way. And I say, you know, the book is my happy ending.
So dating, I mean, I'm in the same situation. I'm not interested in dating. I'm not doing it. The idea of it is, how would I ever perceive if they're faking their whole personality or not? I got tricked the first time. How would I avoid being tricked again? Is that something that comes up in your mind?
100%. I feel exactly the same way. I just feel like to take that risk again, to trust my own judgment, it's really hard to imagine doing it. And people kind of think like, oh, at my age, I'm 56, like the standards should be lower, but I feel like the standards are much higher to share my life again.
Yeah. Hear, hear. I love that. Last question, I think, which is, how are you these days?
How am I?
Yeah.
I'm great. This has been such a great experience because I've been so nervous about this part of it because I am private, or I am shy, I guess. And so being out there in the world scares me a bit, but I'm excited. I feel like I'm in a good place and my kids are in a good place. And, you know, this is an exciting time for me to be starting.
Yay, 56 and starting all over again.
Yes,
with
exactly.
A brand new book and your kids are almost launched. I love that. Congratulations on Strangers.
Thank you so much.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Gundungurra, Gadigal and Muwinina peoples. Ladies, We Need to Talk is mixed by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt, produced by Elsa Silberstein and Sarah Mashman. Supervising producer is Tamar Cranswick, and our executive producer is Alex Lolbach. This series was created by Claudine Ryan. We'll be right back.